Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, we talk about Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike. We talk about Cinderella and Anne and Hit the Wall and Happy Birthday at the Actors Company Theater. And then we also talk about some news. So please stay with us. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, March 17th. Happy St. Patrick's Day 2013. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a 32-year-old.
More than 32 years ago, but that's another story.
Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being the Broadway MVPs 1960 to 2010, the most valuable players of the past 50 seasons. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, and Masterworks Broadway, as well as many other places around the internet. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also, you teased us last week about your upcoming book. Remind us again, is that the runner-ups?
Yes, it's about the musicals that did not win the Tonys, such as Gypsy, Follies, West Side Story. That's why it's been called Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. A very opinionated look at the musicals that did not win the Tony Award. May 28th it comes out.
May 28th, we'll have to remind everybody and put some pre-order stuff up at Amazon or elsewhere before that.
God, love you.
How are you feeling? You getting over that cold?
Still? Yep. It won't be long now. When you're old, you recover slow, you know, so that's what happens. But I'm better than I was last week, as you can hear.
Great. Good to hear. Michael Portantier is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He's also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com and many other places around the internet. Hello, Michael.
Good morning.
Good morning. So let's jump right into it. Peter got a chance to see Vanya, Sonia, Masha, and Spike. Did I get that in the right order?
Yeah, in fact, you did. Chris Durang's play, which started out at the MacArthur Theater in the fall and then moved to Lincoln Center and now has a Broadway engagement. It's quite good. It may be a little long, I will grant you. 2.5 hours is a lot for a comedy. But nevertheless, it's certainly very funny. And yet it does take its basis from Chekhov, dealing with unhappy people. Christine Nielsen and David Hyde Pierce are siblings who are pretty unhappy because they've never really done as much with their lives as they expected to. And it's really a problem because Sigourney Weaver's character, their sister, is this international movie star. We don't really get the impression that she's a great actress, but nevertheless, she is a movie star, perhaps a latter-day Zsa Zsa Gabor for all we know. But nevertheless, one of the problems of the play is that she's been supporting them. She has been paying for their home and the utilities and everything else, I get the impression. And now she figures she's going to pull the plug. She feels she's given them enough, and it's time for them to make their own way in the world. And frankly, I think she has a good point. They resent her terribly for this, saying, oh, you got plenty of money. Well, yeah, but nevertheless, we should all be responsible for ourselves. But it is very Chekhovian in the sense that we have people mulling around and mourning about their lives. Now, the interesting thing here is, of course, that Chekhov always claimed that his plays were comedies, and there's no question that Chris Durang has proclaimed his plays are comedies as well. But this, of course, has many more laughs in it, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that Christine Nielsen is on hand. She is so funny as this semi-ditzy person who sometimes is grounded in reality and sometimes isn't. And But the way she delivers the line is unique. There's no one quite like Christine Nielsen. And if you ever have seen her, this may be the apotheosis of her career. And if you haven't seen her, now's the time. There's no question about that. David Hart Pierce is marvelous, especially in the second act where you, oh, let me go back to Christine Nielsen's monologue, because I was just about to talk about David Hart Pierce. And yet, as funny as Christine Nielsen is, she has a very poignant monologue in Act Two. Very poignant indeed. She's come from a party. She's met a man there, and to her surprise, he's called her because she has felt dumpy and unattractive. And yet, you know, the point is made that there is a lid for every pot-bellied person out there. And Christine Nielsen may very well find romance. So she has a wonderful scene on the telephone where it blows all her fuses that this man would call her. She doesn't know how to react. Sometimes she makes a wrong turn in the conversation and we wince for her. But it works out better than we might expect at some point in the conversation. Okay, on to David Hyde Pierce's monologue, where he talks about what life was like in the 50s. And yes, there were problems in the Eisenhower years, and yes, there were dullness patches. But nevertheless, there were some good things about the 50s, and he brings them up, especially in conjunction with the media and what we were watching on TV and how we related to each other while we were watching shows on TV, bringing up a good point that when there were only three channels, we didn't have as many choices, and people tended to watch TV together because there weren't that many choices anyway. And now with so many choices, everybody's off doing his own thing. It's a marvelous, funny monologue, and he does it with such impassioned pursuit of his ideals that you can't help but enjoying him. I think Sigourney Weaver is quite good too, as this megalomaniac. So, and then there are three newcomers in the show too who are really quite good, especially the character Spike. I should point out that Vanya is David Hyde Pierce, Sonia is Christine Nielsen, Masha is Sigourney Weaver, but Spike is her boy toy, a guy who is in his own wonderful world. He's hard to take, but nevertheless, he pleases himself. And if that's his goal, he's certainly succeeding in that. So he's this very buff young guy who certainly is intriguing to Sigourney Weaver, who is no kid anymore, as he points out from time to time. So a little long, as I say, but an enjoyable evening. I wish it well. I think it's going to do very well at Tony time. It wouldn't surprise me at all if Christine Nielsen wins the prize, because we have to appreciate her for all the nice things she's been doing along the way, especially off Broadway. So good luck to Vanya and Sonia and Masha and even Spike.
Well, that's quite an endorsement. I'm looking forward to seeing it. Michael, you haven't seen the Broadway incarnation yet of it, and I think we talked about it before, but did you want to add anything?
Well, just a couple of things. I also really wish it great luck because, you know, just for a combination of reasons, Durang has not had success on Broadway yet, and I think he really, really deserves it. I think we've discussed Beyond Therapy before, which is one of the funniest things I've ever seen on Broadway. And for some reason, was a huge flop about, when was that, Peter?
Oh, God.
25,
you know,
30 years ago?
I may be wrong about this, but I think David Hyde Pierce was in it. Like
he was.
Bit. Yeah.
He was in it.
I mean, just as a bit part. He was nobody then, but yeah.
So there was that, and then there was Sex and Longing. That one was just not really well written, I thought.
And a history of the American film.
Yeah. I mean, Durang has comic sensibility that I think actually maybe the world is catching up with. Is that fair to say?
I think it might very well be. I don't know if I've ever mentioned this on this podcast. I saw his musical, The Greatest Musical Ever Sung, when he was a sophomore at Harvard, which was essentially forbidden Broadway. He took Broadway show songs and put new lyrics to them, but this was a musical version of the New Testament. So Jesus came in for Palm Sunday. Everybody sang, who took the sins right out of the whore? Jesus.
Who took
us right out of the sore? Jesus. So anyway, So we knew then that that he was going to turn out to be this wonderful satirist, and he certainly hasn't let us down. But yeah, that's a very good way of putting it, Michael, that Broadway may well be catching up to him. I'll tell you, I went to a Wednesday matinee, which was full of Wednesday matinee attendees, and they were rolling in the aisles. They were having a wonderful time.
I'm so glad.
This was a crowd that looked conservative. I mean, if you took a picture of them from the stage, they would look elderly in the way that matinee ladies have traditionally been. But they were having a wonderful time, and I hope the audiences continue to.
Well, I loved it at Lincoln Center, and I seem to remember that within 5 minutes, or maybe like 2 minutes of Christine Nielsen's first entrance, she does something that I won't give away, but it's so hilarious that I thought, oh, this is going to be fun.
What's very interesting, of course, is that David Hyde Pierce gets entrance applause, and Sigourney Weaver gets entrance applause, and Christine Nielsen does not, or at least the day I was there. However, when she made her final exit, boy, did they make up for it then. By then, they'd come to appreciate and love her, and her exit applause was louder than the other two.
She is brilliant. She's a brilliant, brilliant comedian. What was the name of that off-Broadway Durang play that she was in about the...
Witherspoon?
That one, yes, but also the one about the summer house. There were people in like a summer rental. I can't remember. Sorry.
Okay.
But she's worked with him several times, and he is certainly loyal. He's known and worked with Sigourney Weaver since they were in
Yale.
At Yale together.
Sure. They were both in the Chorus of the Frogs.
Right. So anyway, I wish it the best, and I hope it. I'm so glad to hear that the audience response on Broadway was great. I it's really one of the best things I've seen, and I also agree. Partly because of lack of competition among plays, but even if it wasn't for that, it's so good that I hope it'll do well in all the awards, and I hope it's around for a long time.
All right, so. Michael, you going to see the Broadway incarnation of it?
Oh, yeah. I forget my date, but I already have it set.
Yeah, I'm going to see it in about 2 weeks or so. So I got a chance this week to go see Cinderella, and I generally don't see things before they open, so we don't really get much of my input on the reviews here. But I saw it, and Michael also wanted to revisit it. Plus, we had a little column by Mr. Musto over at the Village Voice about Douglas Carter Beane. So I thought maybe we'd just talk for a few minutes about it. So, Michael, what was your epiphany that you had about Cinderella?
Oh, well, as I said, I don't know how brilliant it is, but you can tell me. Maybe it's terribly obvious. I think it occurred to me a large part of the reason why I disliked it so intensely, and so many other people apparently love it. And I think it's because one thing that's changed in culture is it seems that now it's very acceptable to a lot of people to have these kind of mishmash shows and television shows and films where the style is not remotely consistent within the piece, but that doesn't seem to bother a lot of people. It's kind of like you do whatever you need to do in order to get a reaction from the audience. And it's also the theory, I guess, that if you're doing a romantic comedy, maybe that might not appeal to everyone. So you also throw in like very, very snarky humor. And, you know, in case that doesn't work, you throw in something else. You throw in action or whatever. I mean, I'm thinking of these TV shows that I don't watch, but I'm aware of them, like this recent flop show that Stephen Pasquale starred in, which is about a surgeon who also happens to be a split personality Jekyll and Hyde type. It's like, well, okay, so it's not, you know, if just in case people are bored with the stuff about him being a surgeon, then it's also like a almost like a science fiction thing. And then there was the other show that I mentioned, the one with Patrick Wilson, where he was a doctor who is haunted by his ex-wife, and it seems like that's becoming not to me, but becoming acceptable on Broadway also. I mean, Shrek is like that. The movie was like that, and the show was like that too. It's kind of like you do whatever you need to, you know, for a laugh or whatever reaction you want to get at the moment. But to me, Shrek is like it's own creation. You know, it's a new piece, even though they use a lot of well, in the movie they use a lot of old songs and old references and things like that. But to me, Cinderella is or should be an entirely different animal. You know, it was never originally intended to be anything like that. And Rodgers and Hammerstein are both gone and were not able to participate in this total revamp of it. And I guess that's why I object to it so strongly. So what I'm saying is that I guess I can understand why people like it if it doesn't bother them that the tone changes every 3 minutes. But I am surprised that it doesn't bother Peter.
Nah.
And I guess maybe I thought you could address that a little bit more. I would think that would be something that you would not enjoy.
I don't, in fact. And when I reviewed Cinderella, I did point out the fact that I didn't like the contemporary language, such as end of discussion and heads up and things like that. So that did bother me. But to me, it was a case where the assets far outweighed the liabilities, because I really appreciated the fact that the prince was no longer just a one-dimensional pretty boy, that he really had a backstory, that he had his own feelings, his own strengths and liabilities. He was a strong guy where it came to physical, but he was not a strong guy emotionally, because, again, he had been raised without parents and by a regent who made all the decisions. I thought these were good details. So as a result, I came down in favor of Cinderella, even while acknowledging what you're talking about. So that's why I responded the way I did.
Let me ask you, too, about something just to weigh in here. I really enjoyed Cinderella. It was not what I expected. Because I knew the show very well. I've done the show before, and I've seen the
Prince Charming?
Maybe.
I cast you as Prince Charming. Anyway, so go ahead.
It was a long, long time ago, so very far away. But I really enjoyed the show, and I started to think about this in the context of when they update Shakespeare and take Shakespeare and place it in a different situation, whether it be out of space or in the future or something like that. And certainly this was not – they didn't place this in the future or in a different circumstance. It was still there, but the language was different. So how do you feel about the updating of the classics like a Shakespeare or a Moliere or something
Before, let me just mention, I just read an Onion article about, and the title was something like, "In bold move, director sets Shakespeare play in its own time."
I don't even know how it started. I wonder who was patient zero for taking Shakespeare and putting it in a completely different world. But that does seem to this is a question that's occurred to me too over the years, James. Why is this something that people accept or enjoy? I'm not even saying I'm necessarily against it, but I'm just wondering how it happened and why we give it a pass, is the way you're asking too.
Well, I don't think that we give all of them a pass. I think there are productions that do that are wonderful and some that are probably pretty terrible. And of course, the major difference is that in all of those cases, or 99.9% of them, the text is not touched. It's, it's just the staging and the costumes and the props. I'm going to see in a few weeks, I think I mentioned this production of Rigoletto at the Met, where they don't change the music or the libretto, but it's set in Las Vegas in the 1950s or 60s. I forget now. So that's another, they do it a lot at the opera, especially recently. And I guess they've been doing it in Europe for years, and maybe now America is catching up with it, which whether that's a good or bad thing is certainly open to debate. But it is interesting. I think the major difference comes down to whether or not the text is rewritten. And God knows the text of Cinderella has been completely rewritten. Songs have been added. Snippets of songs have been added. So I guess that's how I would, that's the distinction I would make.
Well, sure. I can't disagree with that at all. And yet I do recall last year when I went to London, I love to see Shakespeare in London because I get the impression that they do it better than we do. So I immediately bought a ticket for the Comedy of Errors at the National Theater and licking my lips in anticipation of seeing this great Shakespeare production. And I was disappointed when it was updated to the present day and set in Jamaica. That's not the experience I wanted. I wanted classical Shakespeare in the land where it was done classically originally. So given any circumstance, I would prefer to see Shakespeare done in the traditional fashion, the way the Bard envisioned it. That would be my first choice. And yet I have had some good times at some updatings. Certainly A Merry Wives of Windsor that was set in the 50s, where the two wives really were portrayed like Lucy and Ethel. And yeah, that was fun. But again, Merry Wives isn't as good a play as many of the Shakespeare plays, so I don't mind fooling around with that as much as I – of course, Comedy of Errors isn't either. But the point is my appetite was for great classical acting in the staunch British tradition, and I didn't get it.
I was trying to think of an updated production that I really loved, and the only one that leaps immediately to mind is that incredible production of The Taming of the Shrew in the Delacorte some years ago with Tracy Ullman and Morgan Freeman, set in the Wild West of America. It was so good. I'll never forget that production.
So let's move forward for a second with Michael Musto's story with Douglas Carter-Bean about his Cinderella and his relationship. And I wonder if this happens to the two of you because you have a job to do in reviewing shows in which you become friendly with the folks in either professional friendship or actually a personal friendship with some of these folks. And does this happen to you where you review something and if friends don't know how to react to that are in the show or have written it?
It happened to me at least once that I recall, and it surprised me. There's someone I won't name who I gave very, very supportive reviews of several projects that he did. And I knew him just slightly. I mean, I would see him at various things. And he came over to me one day and said, I really appreciated what you said about this particular project because I think you really understood what we were trying to do. I said, oh, well, thank you. I'm glad, to hear you say it. And then he did another project that was a Broadway project that was very unsuccessful. I mean, there was a consensus that it was unsuccessful artistically, and it had a very, very short run. And I said something about how actually I compared him to himself, this person, and I said that that one song from this previous project has more worth and more theatricality and more beauty in it than this entire new project or something like that. And I passed him somewhere not long after that, and he totally ignored me. He was made a point of ignoring me. And I thought, well, gosh, it's not as if I was in a minority opinion, first of all. And also, I was only comparing him to himself. But I guess it still hurt him,
So, Peter, has this happened to you?
Sure. And you have to budget it into what you do. Sometimes it's more surprising than other times. Certainly, I had pleasant relations with a guy who then wrote me and other critics complaining about a review. And I even addressed it in a column once dealing with it. because it's an interesting circumstance, to say the least. And it's impossible to be in this business for any length of time and not be at parties and meet people and just have a good time with them and strike a rapport. And then, you know, the time comes when you have to review. The one that really interests me has nothing to do with me and Michael, but Stephen Sondheim, of course, was a great building block in the career of Frank Rich. Because he's the one who acclaimed his Harvard Crimson review of Follies as one of the most incisive ones that he had seen on the show, that he invited him to lunch, which was a thrill for this undergraduate to be meeting Stephen Sondheim. And 10 years later, when Merrily We Roll Along opened, Frank Rich had no problems whatsoever in condemning the show in no uncertain terms. So I've often wondered why it hasn't been a situation where Stephen Sondheim has hated Frank Rich ever since, because, you know, he realized that Frank Rich has a job to do and that's his opinion and he's entitled to it. The two certainly have a dog and pony show that they do from time to time in various cities, you know. So, I mean, obviously it isn't a case where Sondheim says, well, I made him and I'll never speak to him again. He obviously got over it. And I think that's really not. And by the way, given the fact that Sondheim and George Firth rewrote Merrily We Roll Along since that famous November 16th, 1981 night that Frank Rich saw it, obviously Sondheim felt that Rich obviously had some good opinions and some points that that he wanted to address, because they had certainly have reworked that show quite a bit. So you know, it is a tough thing, no question about it, to be in this circumstance. But you if you're in this job, you are definitely going to make enemies, and you're going to have to budget yourself that way, just as you do in real life. I mean, not everybody in life is going to like you. A friend of mine once said, you've got to adjust to the fact that 15% of the people you're going to meet and know are not going to like you. Whether or not the statistic is correct, the point is well made.
Right.
That it just happens. You know, people just react to people in different ways, and maybe even because you remind them of somebody from way back when. But we all have to get over it in one way or another.
You know, I just read a quote from Sondheim, and I assume it's accurate. I don't know where the person took it from, but it sounds like him. Sondheim supposedly said, people say that one shouldn't speak ill of the dead, but I say that's the best time to speak ill of them. You know, it's interesting. He seems to have – that does seem to be his generally his point of view. He it seems like for years he went out of his way to not comment on other people, but more recently he has been and we don't know, of course, we're not talking about people as human beings here, we're talking about people as artists,
right?
But you know, he's been recently in his books going after other lyricists and other people who are no longer around for, you know, perceived artistic problems with their work. And I guess for the most part he still avoids doing that with people who are currently working. The major exception, I suppose, might be that Porgy and Bess situation with the ART production, which I still applaud him for, and I think it's one of the greatest things he ever wrote. But that, I suppose, is an exception, because all of those, you know, I mean, Diane Paulus and yeah. Susan Laurie, maybe, Laurie Parks, what?
Or maybe he wanted them all dead, you know.
But you know, he does have his. You know, I guess everyone has a different way of looking at it. And I do agree that the Frank Rich situation is interesting, because for all the reasons that Peter said. I did read how at one of the lectures, one of the discussions with Rich and Sondheim, one of the public discussions, apparently Sondheim made a very strong point about how, to the effect that the only people who write about musicals – drama critics who write about musicals are the only people who get away with writing about something that they have no formal knowledge or training in, meaning music specifically. And he made that point to Rich, and I don't know if it was aimed at Rich, you know, specifically, but I guess that would probably encompass him also. I don't think that he has a degree in music, Frank Rich. So that struck me as I think maybe it's a complex relationship that they have on that level, but it certainly does seem to work in terms of these discussions that they do all over the country.
So talking about complex relationships, Michael got a chance to see Anne. We talked about it last week with Peter. Michael, what did you think about Anne?
Well, I don't have too much to add except to say that I loved it. I thought it was too long. And I thought that it had – I kind of felt that she didn't – that Holland Taylor as an author didn't really know how to end the play very well. It seemed to me like it had two or three different endings. And I'm a little surprised that maybe they didn't bring in a dramaturg to help her kind of focus it, maybe make it into an hour and a half intermissionless piece rather than a 2.5 hour. Closer to 2 hours with intermission. But it did really seem quite long. And I am sorry that she didn't have someone do that, because overall I think it was terrific. Her performance is amazing. She really channels that woman. It's almost as if she came alive on stage again, as far as I could tell. And I'm so glad that she did it. For all the faults that I just mentioned, it's still better written than so many one-person plays, or even non-one-person plays, that I've seen recently. And I applaud her for it. One thing I was surprised at was that Julie White provides the voice of Ann Richards' secretary during much of the play. And I assumed that she was doing it live, but I'm told it was on tape. Did you know that, Peter?
I would have assumed it was on tape. I wouldn't imagine her to show up every performance and do that, given that she's not on stage. That was my assumption.
Well, I mean, I think usually it's done live. Michael Mastro, who already had something of a name as a performer, did it live for the Christopher Plummer play, Barrymore. And I know Julie White is a Tony winner, but I just thought maybe this was, you know, she happened to have a, you know, her schedule free for this few months or whatever, and that she thought it was a project she wanted to be involved with, because I did notice that there was that the timing was very, very slightly off in some of the exchanges with the secretary. There was like maybe an extra half second before she came in.
This reminds me, by the way, of a play called Charlotte that Uta Hagen did back in the 70s. I think it only ran one night, but there were a bunch of previews. And Charles Dellson Riley was in it with her. He didn't say a word. He was essentially a servant who just walked around and did things for her.
Yeah.
And when I said to him, gee, you know, I mean, here you are. You were a famous name. In fact, I think it could be effectively argued that the general public knew you more than they knew Uta Hagen. Why did you take this part where you did nothing at all? He said, because Uta Hagen is such a great actress, I wanted to see her close up every night acting. Very interesting.
Wow.
All right, so let's move forward from Anne into Hit the Wall down at the Barrow Street. Again, Michael saw it, and Peter has talked about it last week. So, Michael, give us a couple minutes on it.
Oh, yeah, I was very disappointed in it. I thought it had wonderful moments, but that it really didn't cohere. It's a sort of a story of the Stonewall Uprising, the famous uprising at the Stonewall Inn, or Stonewall Bar in 1969, that gave birth to the modern gay rights movement. And again, it seemed a little scattershot to me. There were most of the scenes were presented as actual dialogue between actual people happening in the moment. But every now and then, people would say things like, "I was there." And then one or two of the characters said things like, reports differ as to what happened next. So suddenly they're talking to the audience, and I didn't think that was filled in very well by the playwright Ike Holter. So I was disappointed, because I do think that Stonewall is worthy of a really, really great play. I think maybe that he tried to do too much. I remember another off-Broadway play set in Stonewall where Judy Garland's ghost was a character in it. And I actually like that one better. I can't remember the title of it. But this one just tried to, I think, paint on too broad a canvas. And there were a lot of actors in it, and all of them were excellent. I would single out especially Matthew Greer and also Nathan Lee Graham as a black drag queen or transvestite who was fantastic. We've seen him in several shows, and he was really amazing in this one. And the space, as Peter mentioned, the space at the Barrow Street Theater in this case has been reconfigured for basically an In the Round performance. And that was interesting the way they did that. Disappointing, but I guess worth seeing for the performances and also for the subject matter.
So, Peter, you got a chance to see Happy Birthday at the Actors Company Theater. Tell us about that.
I thought it was terrific. This is a 1946 play which starred Helen Hayes. Anita Loos, famous for Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and Helen Hayes were good friends. And Helen said, oh, Anita, why don't you write something for me? And Anita indeed did. This play that not only became a long-running hit at 563 performances, but also turned out to be the play that provided Helen Hayes with her first Tony Award. And one of the reasons that it was her first Tony Award is because it was the first year of the Tonys. So Helen Hayes played Addie, a woman who's had a very sheltered life as a librarian. Her father has really dominated her too, and she hasn't had much of a life, but circumstances bring her to a bar in Newark. And yes, what you think will happen happens. Get a few drinks on her and she livens up and she turns out to have this total transformation. However, this is a play that could be really bad if the actress overdid the drinking. But thank God, Mary Bacon, who's a magnificent actress, and Scott Allen Evans, one of the TACT co-founders and the director of this play, have made sure that while she gets tipsy and then some, she never gets disgusting or caricaturish. And she does wind up finding out what life is about from the vantage point of other people, that she used to judge other people who went into bars like this. And suddenly she saw that some people just like to go in and have a drink and relax, and they're nice people. And it really comes home to her that the life she's been living has been terribly judgmental and terribly narrowed. And there's and her life really changes in this one night. It's what you call a light comedy, of course, and light comedy is often a euphemism for plays that aren't all that funny. There aren't that many jokes in it, gags in it, moments where you really laugh in sustained laughter, but you certainly smile a lot, and you certainly come up with a chortle quite a bit. I'm notorious for not laughing very much at comedies because I've seen so many of them, yeah, and I see patterns in the way that jokes are structured. But I broke out into single laughs, I would say, at least 20 to 25 times, and that's pretty good. So a nice big cast, and not only we have Mary Bacon in the cast, but we also have Karen Ziemba in the cast as one of the owners of the bar into which Addie comes. And it's very interesting to see Karen Ziemba suddenly playing a very Merman-esque character. And suddenly I started thinking, you know, Clea Blackhurst, we're looking forward to seeing in Happy Hunting. But I could see Karen Ziemba doing Merman parts too, because she really had that wonderful swagger. Also keep an eye out for Victoria Mack, who plays somebody who will turn out to be a bit of a rival for Mary Bacon's Addie. She's a nice actress who I've seen many times in New Jersey, and I'm glad to see her here doing very well indeed. But it's really nice that a Tony winner like Karen Ziemba should come and take this, you know, not big part and certainly not the lead, because she believes in the play and believes in the project. So this is a terrific company. They're devoted to finding plays that may have been successful once upon a time, but nobody's thought about them for a long, long time. And they're going to find them. They're going to resuscitate them. And especially given we're talking about a bar, There are plenty of people on hand. It's got a cast of close to 24, and because of that, you know, it's a play that many people would not want to do. It would be too expensive. And the set, of course, is quite lovely, too, a bar. But it's very tastefully designed and smartly designed to make it look like the real thing with that moody atmospheric lighting. So I recommend Happy Birthday very highly. I'm not sure you're going to get to see it again, especially because even though it ran all that time and Hollywood was intent on making a movie of every Broadway hit, this one somehow fell through the cracks. You also get to hear a Rodgers and Hammerstein song in it, I Haven't Got a Worry in the World. And it's supposed to be a popular song of the day. And it's on the jukebox. And Mary Bacon even gets to sing. And she does a nice job of that, too. But this is an actress you really should know. She works with this company quite a bit. And so if you haven't been going to these shows, you haven't been seeing her. But as much as I've admired her in the past, I do think this is the one where you should really catch up with her. And you'll come away saying, wow, you know, if this were on Broadway now, Mary Bacon would be a contender for this year's Tony Award.
Well, we'll have to keep our eyes open for her next project. Michael got a chance to see Old Hats at the Signature Theater Company. Peter is going to be going this week or next week, Peter?
Week after.
So, Michael, why don't you tell us about Old Hats?
Well, I really wanted to see it because I love Bill Irwin and David Shiner when they work together. Full Moon was one of my greatest Broadway experiences, partly because they pulled me up on stage. Yes, David Shiner pulled me up on stage. I'll never forget this. It was years ago. And I remember that I almost didn't go that night because I really wasn't feeling that well. But I went because I was going to be difficult for me to reschedule. I didn't know if I'd be able to. And so I went with a friend of mine, and he pulled me up on stage to be in the movie sequence. I was the jilted lover, the one who comes in at the end and discovers his girlfriend in flagrante delicto in the bar, and it was just an amazing experience. So I can attest personally to the fact that at least some of the people that they pull up on stage are in fact real people and not plants. The interesting thing when I saw it this time was the first person that they pulled up, it almost seemed like it had to be a plant because David Shiner was like putting his hands in her hair and like messing it all up. And I thought, oh my God. So I guess I knew why Charles Isherwood in his New York Times review, he was convinced that everyone was a plant. I know that's not true. And I think maybe he could have researched that a little more before he said that in his review. But they, you know, I guess the line has been really blurred. We mentioned how some shows, I think, have had a mixture of plants and real people. And so you never know really what you're going to get anymore. But they've been doing it for a long time, Shiner and Irwin, and they really know how to do it. And their comedy is really great. And this show is different in that Nellie Mackay provides musical interludes, and she has her own very strange, very loopy, edgy comic sensibility that's different from theirs, but also kind of complements it very well and makes the show more delightful because it's kind of like almost like a musical vaudeville with all these brilliant comedy sketches in them. So I urge anyone to see it. It's at the Pershing Square Signature Center. And
I have to say that there's an actor named Kevin Carolan, and Kevin was in the audience a Full Moon, and they pulled him on stage. And again, an actor. So he really responded very, very well. And at the end of the show, the Red Clay Ramblers, who were part of Full Moon, came up to him and said, you know, you'd be perfect for our new show, Kudzu, which we're doing at Goodspeed. And he got a part out of it.
Oh, wow.
He actually did. Kevin, by the way, is I don't know if he's still doing it, but he was certainly in the original cast of Newsies playing Theodore Roosevelt, who comes in at the end and helps settle matters. So a terrific actor. I've seen him many, many times in New Jersey. I've always enjoyed him. But to think that somebody actually got a part out of being on stage with Bill Irwin and David Shiner is pretty interesting.
That's great.
Okay, so...
By the way, I looked it up, and the Christopher Durang play I was referring to that I could not think of the title of was Betty's Summer Vacation.
Oh, yes.
Christine Nielsen was really great in that.
So the next thing we're going to talk about, Peter and Michael got to see Look Homeward, Angel. And before we had started recording, we talked about the special challenges that you have when you're producing off-Broadway. And we thought that we would talk a little about that. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with Look Homeward, Angel?
Yeah, I won't say much about the show. I'll just talk about the the challenges, because it'd probably be kinder than not saying about the production. It's in the Abington Theater Complex on 36th Street in the Dorothy Strelson Theater, I think that's how you pronounce it, yeah. Which is a very small theater, and that was its first mistake. But I found out, because I have a friend in the cast, it wasn't supposed to be there.
It
was supposed to be in the much, much larger Arclight Theater in the East 70s, which has basically a Broadway-sized stage.
Yes.
Look Homeward, Angel is Kitty Fring's stage adaptation of the novel by Thomas Wolfe about this family that runs a boarding house in North Carolina, and there's a lot of people on stage. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 16 or 17 people, and no doubling of roles. So it was this theater was much, much, much too small for the project. From what I heard, Austin Pendleton directed it, and he had been involved with it for several months. They've been working on it for some time. And when the Arclight Theater fell through for whatever reason, he felt too invested in the production. He didn't want to abandon it, so that he agreed to continue doing it at the Dorothy Strelson, which is, you know, very admirable, obviously, in a way. It's just that it resulted in, you know, he literally had to have people, actors, sit on stage for scenes where they shouldn't have been there because there was nowhere else to put them. And the blocking was very problematic and things like that. So that was the story there. And then, it was 8:02, and we were all lined up to go into the theater. The house had not opened yet. And I finally asked what was going on, and it turns out they made an announcement. There was some kind of a plumbing problem. God knows what that amounted to. And then they said something like, gentlemen, if you go to the men's room, please be careful.
Wow.
So we went in at like 8:05, and then fortunately, as I say, it's a very small theater, and they got everyone in quickly, and they started right away, so it didn't start much more than 10 or 12 minutes late. The challenges of off and sometimes off Broadway can be pretty daunting sometimes, especially with large cast plays.
Well, I'm glad you told me that, Michael. I had no idea that this was a case of a show being moved, because everybody was so crowded up there. At one point, my girlfriend turned to me and said, this is like the stateroom scene in Night at the Opera. You know, there were so many people in this tiny, tiny room. So that explains a lot. Frankly, I did not see the whole show. It wasn't that I didn't enjoy watching it, but yes, I haven't been well lately, and I started coughing like crazy, and I couldn't stop. So I almost became a character in the show because I was coughing so much, and because it was so small, and because there's so little demarcation between the audience and the actors on stage, that the first row is right on top of them. I mean, there's no stage. It's just a floor. So I took my leave after the first act. But I hope to get back to see the rest of it, because this, after all, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning play. And it's one that's underserved. Another one that, even though it was a hit and ran over 500 performances, didn't get a movie version, which is a little surprising, you know, considering it has this famous title from the Thomas Wolfe novel. So it doesn't.
That really is surprising, isn't it?
Isn't it? Yeah, yeah.
And no, also, it would make a good movie in several ways because it's very expansive. It's there are scenes in different places. That's a surprise.
I wonder. It's not impossible that it was sold to the movies and then it just fell through development hell cracks. That could very well be. I've never heard that it did get sold, but that seems to be a more likely scenario than it's not getting sold at all. But nevertheless, it also was the basis for a musical in, I think, 1978, which only ran a weekend. And it prompted me to take out the original cast album because there's one of the characters Ben Gant very much enjoys the company of a heavyset woman. And in the musical, he sings this big ballad about her called I Call Her Fatty. And I'll love my fatty till I die. You know,
yes.
It's amazing, you know, that it's supposed to be this compliment. But somehow calling a heavyset woman fatty strikes me as not the most wonderful compliment that one can pay her, but
well, that name was very much in the play too, and I assume
yeah.
the novel. And I actually think Peter, I think that's one reason why this play is not done more often. No, because it's kind of essential. I mean, you could change it. I almost thought, well, if I did it, I would change it and call her Fanny. You know, because it's just so unacceptable. Sure. Now they keep talking about how he talks about how wonderfully plump and round she is, and I mean, in a way, I suppose that part of it is good, you know, that he
yeah
that he,
sure
you know he's
sure.
very attracted to this woman because yeah. of her personality, and she's so kind and wonderful, and you know, but I guess it's the word itself that is so that has such a negative connotation, you know.
Sure.
So old Roscoe Arbuckle. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Fatty Arbuckle.
Fatty Arbuckle. What was the prominence there? Do you think he appreciated being called Fatty?
Well, that was for, you know, that was his character.
Yeah.
Aside from being his true girth, you know.
And I don't know, there's still something that's
I know exactly what you're saying, yeah.
Go ahead, yes.
No. Sure, it's sort of why I don't watch American Idol, because it seems like people are more interested in seeing people crash and burn the mean side of it than the than to really be giving a tribute and a way of saying I love you in a different way.
The actress who plays it here certainly is right for the role. She's a big girl, as we say, and she certainly did what was required of the part, which is not be flustered by his word at all. I mean, she was very secure in the fact that he had great affection for her. So, I'm so sorry they didn't get the big stage. It would have made such a difference.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're just going to run through some news of the week right now. We'll just chime in here with a few sentences here of what you're thinking about these things. Did you hear that Helen Mirren is doing a show called The Audience, yeah. and that the dog was fired?
No, I didn't.
They fired the dog because Helen was not happy with the way in which the dog was responding to her.
Oh.
And David Ng over at the Los Angeles Times wrote a very funny story about it. And it was all tongue-in-cheek. And, you know, but these things, children and animals on stage,
well,
what do you
the
do?
The dog in Annie 2. The ill-fated sequel to Annie. I don't mean Annie Warbucks. Between
sure.
Annie and
yeah.
Annie Warbucks, there was Annie 2, a musical that closed in Washington. The Sandy was fired in that one, too. Greg Edelman tells the story of when he was in a musical called The Shop on Main Street, and it was an off-Broadway show. They had no money, and they needed a dog because Greg Edelman's best friend was the dog, and he would say, oh, Toto, you know, I love you, and oh, we're in trouble, or, you know, that type of thing. And they couldn't afford a dog. The stage manager said, well, I have a dog. You know, we can. Well, anyway, the dog turned out to have stage fright and ran off. And the thing was, the stage manager was essentially castigating the dog. You know, and suddenly, as Greg says, the dog made a yelp, the type of sound you hear when a dog is really in pain.
Oh.
And he said, from then on, the audience hated us. We couldn't do anything right because we had hurt the dog.
So, do you remember in the revival of Showboat at the Gershwin, there was that there's some sort of change in time scene,
yeah,
and they had a dog walk across the stage with somebody as part of this thing that Susan Stroman had choreographed, and when it came up for contracts, the joke in the cast was that the dog got a bigger raise than everybody else. Because it actually, you know, on paper in hard numbers was true, because the dog had a handler that had to have car service back and forth to the theater, and then Stritch wanted car service back and forth to the theater, and it became this big thing, and Hal Prince's office was involved, and it was just very funny. Anyway, dogs, animals, and children on stage.
Wonder if they found they just had a casting call for the cat for Breakfast at Tiffany's. I believe it must have been for the understudy, because they've been doing the show, and I guess there's a cat in it, but they wanted to find another cat for the cover or the understudy or whatever, and I don't know what happened with that.
I just can't imagine. It's near impossible to train a cat. So
I know Matt, Sue went to try out for Miss Hannigan, and she had to bring a dog with her because the dog hadn't been terribly well or something like that. You guessed it. She didn't get a call back, but the dog did. They said, you know, we'd love to use your dog as Sandy. So it's true.
All right. Speaking of some cats, that Jason Robert Brown, his Honeymoon in Vegas is going to have a pre-Broadway run at the Paper Mill.
Yeah.
Jason is last 5 years, as we've mentioned, is not one but two productions here in New York, and the production at Second Stage has been extended twice before it even opens.
Right.
So it's very popular. I'm looking forward to see that. And
Jason has a show at Williamstown too, Bridges of Madison County.
So he's
happening this summer. So
we
haven't heard from him for a while, and now we understand why.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And I'm not sure if it's 100% official, but we're hearing that Tony Danza is going to be starring the Paper Mill show.
Oh, yeah. Didn't I say that? I must not have said that. Yeah, that's what the rumor is. Tony Danza is starring in it.
A nice little off-Broadway musical, The Other Josh Cohen, is going to turn up on the Paper Mill stage. It's a very good musical. I'm not sure it's right for Paper Mill because it's a very small show, but I wish it well. And certainly they're giving a brand new musical a chance, a semi brand new musical a chance, and the rest of the season is pretty conventional with shows like Oliver. But still, credit where it's due for at least getting two shows in there that aren't household names.
Yes.
So another household name is Carole King. He's got a show coming to Broadway, Beautiful, the Carole King musical. We just heard about. So that's. We're looking forward to that. That's going to be that was big in the news this week, as well as another Carol Churchill's got going to be featured in the new season at New York Theater Workshop. So we have the Carols all covered.
There's the Carly Simon. I always get those two confused.
You're so vain. So and we mentioned last week about Ken Davenport's blog and various things that he's written about. One of the things that he's doing, and I wanted to mention it here, is that he is he's having, I guess, a contest, if you will. He took applications online for various people who wanted to be an associate producer on Macbeth and somebody who could come to all the producer meetings and do everything and learn how to raise money and be a part of a Broadway show. And I thought that was very interesting to do something like that publicly, taking, you know, an application process, and he's whittled it down to 12 people. And I think it's going to be very interesting. And it's so important to develop new producers, younger producers, to bring up new works. And I thought that this was very interesting to do.
Ken's one of the best in thinking out of the box. No question about it.
Yeah. You know, I have to link back. We had Ken on this on our broadcasts here in the very beginning when we first started recording. And I'll have to link back to some of those so if folks can hear him in his own words. He's pretty much a very original, out-of-the-box thinker. Jenna Fischer from The Office, the television show, the wildly popular American version of The Office, is going to be in Neela Butte's Reasons to be Happy. And I mention this because Jenna brings quite a following with her. So I wonder if this is going to translate well. It'll see if we, because her audience is a very much a younger audience. So I wonder if they're going to go to this off-Broadway show. And Neela Butte is a wonderful writer. So we'll have to.
This is a sequel to Reasons to be Pretty.
Mm-hmm.
It does take the same characters and takes a look at them a few years later.
So that'll be great.
I agree.
And then household names again. Signature is bringing some new works of Edward Albee, Laying an Egg. I don't know. We have to.
Yeah, huh?
Let's just hope it's really good because you know, it's like it was like when the Dodgers decided to produce Titanic, and I just was very nervous about that title and the New York Post and. And things like what they could do with that. Right. So that's further on our household names is Barry Manilow's Harmony is getting booked by theaters around the nation.
Oh, really?
So I'm interested. It's going to play at the in LA, and it's I think also scheduled in Atlanta or somewhere else. But we mentioned a few weeks ago when we were talking about Barry's show that I had heard rumblings that Harmony was back on track to come into Broadway in 2014. And it seems like they're starting to build some momentum here. So
great.
It was funny that when I went to see the concert at the St. James, as I was walking in, a critic said to me, "You think he'll do a song from Harmony? Ha ha ha." Meaning he never would, but he did.
Right.
You know, so as a result, obviously this is something still near and dear to his heart as well as should be. And boy, old musicals never die. They don't even necessarily fade away. And here's one that's rising. So good luck to it.
Well, I think with the huge success of Barry's concert show thing at the St. James that you just mentioned, I think this has put it I think a lot of ease into the ability to raise money for this. That
sure
big audience for it.
Sure,
and it's certainly if Broadway were just a stop on a tour for Harmony, it would make even more sense.
Right.
So, and the last of the household names, I of course am talking about Michael Portantier. Well, oh. Will Swenson versus Superman. His. on Broadway Stars, his interview. Why don't you tease the Will thing, and then we'll say goodbye for the day.
Oh, yeah. Will is playing Max Mencken in It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman, which is being presented by Encores this week. And this was the role that was originally played by Jack Cassidy. And it's interesting, in our interview, Will said that his impression was that the role had been built up specifically to show off, as he put it, Jack Cassidy's gorgeous voice. That's probably true as far as I know. It'll be interesting to see how Superman goes over, because it was one of those shows, it got largely very good reviews, but for some reason the public didn't respond at the time in 1966. So this may be another case where the sensibility of the public has changed to meet the show in a way. It's a very satirical show. So I would not be surprised if people say, hey, you know, this is really good and really funny. I wonder why it didn't run the first time. We'll see. And just a funny story. I was walking yesterday. Today's Sunday, the 17th, is technically St. Patrick's Day, but I guess it's really Saturday because that's when everyone does all their drinking, and also that's when the parade is, too. I don't even know if I realized that. Did you all know that?
The parade was yesterday,
I mean, is it always on the Saturday?
No.
I guess it's this year.
Okay, all right. Well, anyway, so there were a lot of those people on the street, and I was walking up Ninth Avenue, and who do I see walking down the other way but Ed Watts, who plays Superman. And I thought, well, maybe, you know, he could hang around and kind of clean up the streets, you know, of these kind of these low-life drunks who are walking around and puking all over the place.
All right. So I want to do something that I don't think that we've done before, but I want to mention it now, is that I want to give the listeners some homework. Michael forwarded on to Peter and me a link this week called Psychic Infection, The Canaries in the Coal Mine. And it talks about how Broadway needs to prevent itself from going down the road that other entertainment industries have gone. And he talks about the sports industries and the movie industry and television industry. And I'm going to link to it in the show notes. And I'd love for folks to take a look at this brief article. It's about 300 or 500 words, something like that. And get in touch with us. Go to broadwayradio.com. And go to the contact information and email us and let us know your thoughts on this article, because we're going to talk about it next week. I think it's very important.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that one of his main points is that the dynamic ticket pricing that exists in the airline industry and the other ones that James mentioned, in his opinion, is not working for Broadway and has pissed off a lot of people and has resulted in, you know, people not being able to get good tickets if they try to plan ahead. But, you know, so then do you wait to see, you know, to see if tickets are going to be freed up closer to the date? You know, that's much more easier said than done. It's a very, very, very interesting article.
Great. So please go to broadwayradio.com. Take a look. There's a link to that that piece, and then send us some feedback. On a personal note, we want to wish Elise Summer a quick recovery. She broke her ankle. She's from Curtain Up, the theatrical review site that is got. Boy, I bet you they've reviewed thousands of shows, mm-hmm. at least. She's very, very busy with reviewers all over the world, in fact. So please get better, Elise. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe button there. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If you want to listen to us in another way, you can listen to us on the Stitcher app, which is a way to stream our shows to your iPod and your iPhone and your Android and your BlackBerry devices. Or you can listen to us on Broadway World Radio, Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. As I mentioned before, at BroadwayRadio.com, you can see links to some of the things that we've talked about today. That way you can stay up with us and also get in contact with Peter, Michael, and me. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.